Today's broadcast was originally recorded on May 15th, 2024.
Donald Trump lost two debates to me in 2020. Since then, he hadn't shown up for debate. Now he's acting like he wants to debate me again. Well, make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice. So let's pick the dates, Donald. I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
Oh! Snap.
I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, thanks.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in on other fine stations in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Not to mention streaming coast to coast and around the globe on the internets and available at all your favorite podcast sites. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is the Bradcast. Yes, I'm your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. And yes, we've got another big show for you today with
yes,
a whole lot to get for Hello, Desi Doyen.
Hey.
All right, coming up, we will be joined by Heather Digby Parton and Keith Barber for our, what is now, I guess, a weekly tradition. That would be our Trump trial midweek catch-up with a K. Amid perhaps the most dramatic, certainly the most important, I think, week in his New York criminal trial so far. And at least the most dramatic one that didn't feature testimony from a porn star in any event. But first, it was primary election day on Tuesday in Nebraska, Maryland, and West Virginia, with most of the focus on down-ticket races, given the fact that the presidential contests are all but officially decided at this point, as you may have heard. And yet, once again, as we have seen week after week after week during the primary season, since both Joe Biden and Donald Trump clinched their respective parties' nominations, telltale signs of, well, something in the presidential races nonetheless. In state after state, week after week, we have seen a similar pattern, and we see it once again in Tuesday's results in, well, at least two of the three states that held presidential primaries on Tuesday. Among party voters, Joe Biden continues to outperform Donald Trump among those who bother to show up and vote in each party's primary. In Nebraska, Joe Biden received 90% over the 10% that Congressman Dean Phillips received in the presidential primary. Phillips is the only other person who was on the Democratic ballot in Nebraska. He's sort of now serving as sort of a protest vote against Biden. But Biden won 90 to 10. On the Republican side, Trump received just 80% of the vote in Nebraska, as the zombie campaign of Nikki Haley received almost 18% of the vote so far. I should note that these are still unofficial tallies and not all of the numbers are in. But Trump got 80%. Nikki Haley got almost 18%, with another candidate named Perry Johnson picking up about 2% of the vote in that state. It was similarly embarrassing for Trump in Maryland, where Haley's non-existent campaign won a full 20% of the vote, as counted so far, with Trump also winning only 80% there. Biden, meanwhile, won over 86% of the Democratic vote, with uncommitted, which has been where available, sort of a placeholder for those registering disapproval of Biden's policy on Israel, with uncommitted getting about 10%. Actual candidates who have since dropped out of the race, Phillips and Marianne Williamson, they won about 3% between them. So Biden outperformed Trump among his own electorate in both of those states, as we have seen happen so far this year in state after state. Make of it what you will. And then in really the one exception that I recall seeing really at all this season is the great and very red state of West Virginia, which also held primaries on Tuesday. There, Donald Trump outperformed Joe Biden among those who showed up to vote in their respective primaries, with Trump picking up about 88% of the vote, with Haley and others getting about 12%. Biden, on the other hand, in a very low turnout Democratic primary in the state, it's West Virginia after all, he won only 70% of the vote as tallied to date, with three other candidates picking up about a quarter of the vote. Again, make of all of that what you might, but again, it does seem worth noting.
Yeah, Nikki Haley's zombie campaign is really strong.
And maybe Donald Trump's campaign is kind of soft among his own party. As to the other races of note, down ticket on Tuesday, the MAGA primary challenge in Nebraska by Dan Fry against, well, I guess the not MAGA enough Republican congressman Don Bacon, ended with Bacon frying Fry by 24 points in the purplish 2nd Congressional District in the Omaha area, setting up another face-off between Bacon and Democratic State Senator Tony Vargas, who almost cooked Bacon back in 2022. You're
Ouch.
Welcome. We will see. And this Omaha area, this Congressional District, because Nebraska is one of only two states, Nebraska and Maine, who actually separate their electoral votes by congressional district. That 2nd congressional district in Omaha, which has gone to Democrats lately, could play a very key part in this year's presidential election. Just write that down in your, put stick a pin in that until we get to November. Congressman Bacon was not endorsed, interestingly enough, by the state Republican Party. They chose to endorse his failed opponent instead. And as a matter of fact, state party leaders endorsed challengers to all of the state's incumbent Republican members of Congress, all of whom won the nomination on Tuesday. Nonetheless, it's kind of a crazy world.
Yeah.
Or I guess a crazy party, when the state GOP leaders choose to endorse opponents of the party's own sitting incumbent members of the U.S. House. But yep, that's what they did in Nebraska. In Maryland, Democratic Congressman David Trone had spent some $60 million on the Democratic primary to try and win the U.S. Senate nomination to fill the seat being vacated by retiring Democratic Senator Ben Cardin. But David Trone lost on Tuesday. In fact, he was trounced by about 12 points so far by Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrooks, who had the support of party leaders. She will face popular former Republican Governor Larry Hogan this November in what will be a very closely watched Senate race. Hogan is popular and could flip the seat from blue to red, the Senate seat, even as an anti-Trumper himself. If Alsobrooks wins, however, she would become only the third black woman to be elected to the U.S. Senate in the nation's history. And in West Virginia, where right-wing Democratic U.S. Senator Joe Manchin is finally retiring, a staunchly pro-union candidate by the name of Glenn Elliott, who was endorsed by Manchin, easily won the Democratic nomination with more than 45% of the vote over Marine vet and community organizer Zach Shrewsbury and the criminally convicted former coal baron and former Republican pretending to be a Democrat, Don Blankenship, who picked up just over 18% of what suffices for the Democratic vote in West Virginia. Elliott will now run in November against the former Democrat turned Republican just after he won the governorship. That would be Jim Justice, the West Virginia coal baron and, yes, billionaire governor in what could be another blue to red flip in the U.S. Senate this fall. in what's going to be a very difficult year for Democrats in the upper chamber, who will have to pretty much run the board on all of the contested seats and win the White House in order to retain control of the upper chamber this year. Next week on Tuesday, we'll see primary elections in Kentucky and in the great state of Oregon, though only on the Democratic side, if I've got that right. And there will be some local and judicial races taking place in one of my favorite battleground states. That would be, of course, you guessed it, Georgia. Always on my mind. And speaking of the White House, on Wednesday morning, perhaps hoping to shake things up, President Biden laid down the gauntlet, challenging Donald Trump to two early debates this year, two early presidential debates. After sending a letter to the Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates saying he would not participate in the ones that they had scheduled later in the year. That is something, by the way, Donald Trump, I believe, had already said he would not participate anymore in the debates put on by the Nonpartisan Commission. Well, Joe Biden joined him on Wednesday. In the Biden-Harris campaign letter to the commission, they argued that the, quote, years-long presidential commission model for debates is out of step with changes in the structure of our elections and the interests of voters. Among the reasons for why they are out of step, the campaign said, the commission's schedule has debates that only begin after the American people have begun to cast their votes in early voting, and they do not conclude, quote, until after tens of millions of Americans have already voted. Citing their, quote, failure yet again to schedule debates that are meaningful to all voters, not just those who cast their ballots late in the fall or on Election Day. And in fact, that's true. They start voting, for example, in Pennsylvania, as I understand it, in September. And yet they weren't going to hold the Presidential Commission on Debates, was not going to hold a debate until some point in October. And then the last one, as I have to agree with Biden that the last one would have been held after tens of millions of Americans will have already voted. What sense does that make? The campaign also noted that the commission's model is to build, quote, huge spectacles with large audiences at great expense when they should be held for the audiences at home, not for, quote, in-person audience with raucous or disruptive partisans and donors who consume valuable time with noisy spectacles of approval or jeering. And they cite the original televised debates back in 1960, which were held in a TV studio between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon, with just the two candidates and the moderators in the studio. They cite that as a better way to proceed. And they note that while the commission includes rules that candidates were called upon to follow, the commission proved, quote, unable or unwilling to enforce those rules in the 2020 debate. And with that, Biden released both the letter and the challenge to Donald Trump in a video on Twitter after the former president had previously said that he would be willing to do so, that he'd be willing to debate, quote, any time and any place.
Donald Trump lost two debates to me in 2020. And since then, he hadn't shown up for debate. Now he's acting like he wants to debate me again. Well, make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice. So let's pick the dates, Donald. I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
So that free on Wednesday is, of course, a reference to Trump's New York criminal trial, which takes Wednesdays off. Well, I guess Joe Biden's day has been made, because within hours, it was all set, believe it or not.
That was quick.
We will see, however, if it falls apart before we actually get to the debates.
True.
But at least as of Wednesday, both candidates agreed to two debates to be held in studio without an audience. The first will be hosted, apparently, by CNN in Atlanta on June 27 to be moderated by Jake Tapper and Dana Bash, and the second hosted by ABC on September 10. Both candidates have apparently agreed to them. So we will see debates. Mark it on your calendar, June 27 and September 10. And then, I guess unless they add more, there will be no more debates between September 10 and Election Day on November 5.
Well, I don't know that really we need to see more than that. I mean, to be honest, we had 4 years of Trump. We saw what he did. We have 4 years of Biden. We saw what he did. And now they're talking about what they're going to do. Do we really need more than two?
Maybe. We will see. We will see. By the way, neither of those debates will include any of the third party candidates, such as Robert F. Kennedy Jr., which apparently both candidates must believe to be in their own best interest, because boy, did they snap up this opportunity quick. In any event, we will no doubt have many more thoughts on all of that, I suspect, in the days ahead, presuming these plans stay on schedule and that neither of the two candidates find a reason to wriggle out of them. Can you tell I'm sort of, we'll see. I'm sort of suspicious here.
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see if, we'll see if they both stay in. Anyway, since as Biden said, Trump is free on Wednesdays, that must mean we're free as well to get you all caught up on the stuff you may have missed over the past several days in the first, but hopefully not last, trial of a former U.S. president. That is straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
I hope every American at home who isn't able to be in that courtroom is able to see what's actually happening there. And when you do, we will have a landslide of historic proportion this November if every American understands the injustice that's playing out in that courtroom today. So may God bless our country. I pray for our future. And let's pray for our country being stronger on the other side of this disgusting sham politician prosecution.
What?
I know why.
Sham politician.
He can't hold his head up high.
That's what he said.
Stormy Daniel.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Oh, Vivek. That theme song, by the way, that you are hearing, courtesy of Bethany Barber, that means that, yep, it's another Trump trial catch-up with a K segment of the Bradcast, once again with two panelists joining me momentarily, one of them the proud father of Bethany Barber, who was singing that tune. Over the past 2 days, former Trump attorney and fixer and convicted federal felon for a number of crimes performed as Trump's attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen has been on the witness stand in New York Superior Court Justice Juan Merchan's Manhattan courtroom, where Cohen has detailed the hush money scheme involving adult film actress Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. Cohen walked through the $130,000 that he paid at, quote, the direction and benefit of Donald Trump, and detailed his eventual fallout with the former president not long after the FBI raided him, and he was eventually indicted. We're talking about Cohen here on conspiracy charges of campaign finance fraud and others related to the scheme that he would eventually plead guilty to. A scheme, according to his plea, that was, quote, directed by Donald Trump. The scheme involved paying off Daniels for her silence just before the 2016 election and just after the embarrassment of the release of the Access Hollywood tape in which Trump is heard boasting about assaulting women. The 34 felony crimes of which Trump now stands accused have to do with falsifying business records to hide his reimbursements to Cohn that were paid out in monthly $35,000 checks personally signed by Trump during the first year of his presidency in hopes of covering up the entire hush money scandal. Cohn's testimony this week during questions from prosecutors, he tied together the allegations that Trump broke the law by falsifying business records to reimbursing Cohen and concealing the payment. Trump, of course, has pleaded not guilty and denies having an affair with Daniels at all, despite her very detailed testimony to that end under oath last week in the trial. As we've been covering this first ever criminal trial of a former president over the past several weeks of testimony, witness after witness has detailed the way in which the payments to Cohen, the ones at the heart of this case, the falsified payments, according to prosecutors, the way they had technically occurred and the virtual impossibility that the notoriously stingy and hands-on boss Donald Trump would not have known that those checks were actually to reimburse Michael Cohen. They were for exactly that. They were not for legal fees as falsely documented in the Trump Organization business records. That according to the prosecution. Trump apparently called them a legal retainer, or at least that's how they were marked on the checks and on the invoices, legal retainers to for fees to Cohen. Instead, it was to pay him back for the $130,000 payment he made to Daniels on Trump's behalf before the election to help him cheat to win it. But none of those witnesses until this week actually testified to knowing that Trump himself was, in fact, aware of the fraudulent payment scheme, specifically structured to avoid both campaign finance laws and detection by officials or the public. But during Cohen's first day on the stand on Monday, Trump himself was finally placed directly, knowingly, at the very heart of this fraudulent payout scheme by Cohn's testimony detailing the smoking gun evidence, a bank statement featuring the handwriting of both Michael Cohen and currently jailed for perjury and longtime Trump Organization chief financial officer Alan Weisselberg. That statement breaks down the specific payment scheme that was put in place to avoid detection. It's a document that, according to Cohen, both he and Weisselberg jointly discussed with Donald Trump himself in Donald Trump's own office in Trump Tower just after he had won the 2016 election, as helpfully summarized here by MSNBC's Rachel Maddow on Monday night.
Michael Cohen gave testimony today that Donald Trump was in the room where it happened in the worst possible way. The one piece of paper that has emerged in this case that is the most important piece of paper of all is this one. This document, People's Exhibit 35, is the smoking gun document in this first ever criminal trial of an American president. It is a bank statement showing the wire transfer of $130,000 to the representative for Stormy Daniels. It's the bank record showing that the hush money payment was in fact made. And on the bottom of the bank statement, on the right, you see what we now know is Michael Cohen's handwriting showing something else he wants to be reimbursed for, since we now understand he's leaving the Trump Organization. At this point, he wants to make sure in this last payment that's coming to him, this other money the Trump Organization owes him is going to be included. That's on the bottom right side of this piece of paper. On the bottom left side of this piece of paper, you see different handwriting. This is handwriting from the Trump Organization's CFO, Alan Weisselberg. And it's him doing the math. This is how much Michael Cohen is owed, since we're going to lie and say this is income for him instead of the reimbursement that it actually is. That means he's going to have to pay taxes on it. So here's how much we'll add to what we're paying him to account for the taxes he's going to have to pay. Here's the add additional bonus line because he said he was owed money on his annual bonus and he's never getting another one because he's leaving the organization. Here's the over 12 part at the bottom there. That means we're going to pay it over 12 months. So it's $420,000 over 12 months. That's $35,000 a month. That's Alan Weisselberg doing the math. That document, People's Exhibit 35. What prosecutors have laid out is that that is the smoking gun document that shows the crime. It shows what the payment was really for and how it was disguised as something else in the business records of the Trump Organization. And it was disguised as something else in order to conceal its true nature, because its true nature was that it was a campaign expenditure. That's the prosecution's case. That document shows the crime. But today, Michael Cohen testified for the first time that Trump was there for it. That he, Michael Cohen, and Alan Weisselberg, the Trump CFO, talked it over, during which time they made those notes on that piece of paper. That's why there's two different sets of handwriting on that piece of paper. After the two of them marked up that piece of paper the way I just described, they then took that piece of paper and marched it down to Donald Trump's office on the 26th floor of Trump Tower. And with that paper in hand, the three of them had a discussion about what exactly they were doing and why they were doing it. And he said, do it. Did Mr. Weisselberg have with him this document, People's Exhibit 35? He did. Did he show this document to Mr. Trump? Yes. Michael Cohen testifying today for the first time that just before leaving to be inaugurated as president of the United States, Donald Trump reviewed the smoking gun document that laid out the crime. He then talked in detail about the crime with his CFO and with Michael Cohen, and he said, quote, do it. Quote, he approved it.
He approved it. That, according to Michael Cohen, who Trump's defense attorney, Todd Blanche, would subsequently go on to try and attack during cross-examination late on Tuesday, trying to attack him as a liar who actually went to jail for lying to Congress and other federal officials who simply cannot be trusted. Never mind, as he explained, that those lies he was held to account for example, lying about Trump's business dealings with Russia before the election, were actually told on behalf of and to protect Donald Trump himself. Cohen's cross-examination will continue on Thursday, after which the prosecution says they will rest their case against Trump. Cohen will be the final witness for the prosecution. Trump's lead attorney, Todd Blanche, told the judge on Tuesday that Trump still has yet to decide whether to testify himself. Don't hold your breath, despite months of promises that he would do so, or whether they would even put on any defense at all. Also, over the past several days of Trump's New York criminal trial, now I believe in its fifth week, after next to nobody showed up in support of Trump inside the courtroom for the first several weeks, other than just recently his son Eric, a veritable parade of deplorables and/or Republican vice presidential hopefuls, most of them wearing Trump red ties and navy blue suits, have showed up at the Manhattan courthouse to sit through testimony and, most importantly, submit their audition tapes for Trump love and/or to be selected as his Veep this year by giving remarks to the media outside the courthouse to say stuff that Trump wants to say but can't due to the gag order against him, which he has already been found to have criminally violated at least 10 times. That parade of horribles and deplorables so far this week has included Ohio U.S. Senator J.D. Vance and Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville, along with at least two state attorneys general who otherwise rarely seem to find time to show up to courtrooms to sit in support of criminal defendants. Also, vice presidential hopefuls North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, Florida Congressman Byron Donalds, and Vivek Ramaswamy were there on Tuesday. You heard Vivek describe this sham politician, oops, prosecution at the top of this segment. Also, the Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, showed up to pay his respects to the boss. All were seated behind Trump for much of the day, except for Johnson, who appeared in the hallway with Trump for for his morning remarks to the press, but did not go inside the courtroom, apparently. Here's just some of what those folks had to say outside the courthouse on Tuesday.
All of us are here as friends of Donald Trump, supporting him in our personal capacity.
President Trump is innocent of these charges.
The American people have already acquitted Donald Trump.
The judicial system in our country has been weaponized against President Trump.
This trial is a joke. This thing is a farce.
It is one of the most depressing places I have been in my life.
There's no crime here.
Where's the crime? There is no crime.
We have a Biden donor judge.
The real bookkeeping that we need accounting of is Judge Merchant's own family member collecting millions of dollars as a Democratic operative.
It's so corrupt and everybody knows it.
Zounds. Joining us now once again for our midweek Trump trial catch-up are Heather Digby Parton, the award-winning columnist at Salon and longtime blogger at Digby's Hullabaloo, and former attorney and lifelong Republican until now, Keith Barber, who now blogs on the law and Constitution at the Progressive Daily Coast. Welcome again to both of you to the show that never ends, guys.
Glad to be here.
Glad to be here, Brett.
We will we'll get to what happened inside the courtroom over the past week and how it may or may not have played to the jury. But Heather, outside the courtroom, what Trump himself described as surrogates, such as Vivek and Speaker Johnson, et cetera, from the Law and Order Republican Party, were playing either to the American people or to Donald Trump himself with their remarks. Which one is it, and how will that serve him, Donald Trump among the electorate, frankly, if at all, as you see it?
Well, I think primarily these people are you know, playing to Donald Trump. I mean, he put out the call a couple of weeks ago that he was upset that his supporters hadn't shown up. I think we even talked about it last week about how, you know, his supporters hadn't shown up. The family isn't there, although I'm sure he doesn't want them to be there, except for Eric, of course. And then, you know, the fact that he wasn't getting the political support that he expected. So he clearly put out the word. And last Friday, Rick Scott, the Florida senator, a.k.a. Nosferatu, showed up at the at the trial and started this routine that they're now all doing, which is they come to the trial, they show up, and the press notes that they're there. They spend about 45 minutes in the courtroom. Then they get up and leave, and they go out and hold a press conference and say everything that Trump is not allowed to say due to the gag order. And that's what they're doing for him. And, you know, granted, part of it is that they're there for him. And then, of course, there are the VP, you know, auditions. They're mm-hmm. doing kind of a little apprentice, you know, thing, showing right. up and doing, you called it audition tapes. So there's that, too. And, of course, all the, you know, Tim Scott better step it up tomorrow because yes. he's losing altitude here with it. He hasn't been there. I think he might be there tomorrow. I really do. That's what this is about. And I think that whether or not this has any, I doubt it has any effect whatsoever on the electorate, aside from the MAGA people who love to see anybody, you know, licking Trump's boots in public. That makes them all very excited because that's what they do too. So, you know, I mean, this is part of their whole cult ritual.
But
and,
of course,
so they're enjoying it.
A cult ritual. That's well said.
They would be supporting him anyway. So that's probably not going to make a difference other than to make them happy about that, I guess. But you write at Salon today, Heather, to suggest that this does not end well for those folks who are showing up at the courthouse. Why is that?
Well, because look at what we're observing inside the courtroom. Michael Cohen was the most loyal of henchmen that Trump has ever had. Yeah. I mean, this guy, he has said he would take a bullet for him. And what you're seeing is this diminished, you know, kind of humiliated man sitting on the witness stand, having to admit over and over again that he was not only he was a liar, he was a fool, he was a dupe. He had got sent to jail. He got sent back and had to go to solitary confinement. All of this in service of Donald Trump. And mm-hmm. and he even says throughout it that, you know, he just wanted to get his approval. He just was, you know, yearning for, you know, Donald Trump to understand how much he really cared for him and how much he was doing for him. Well, here are those people, a whole lineup of them sitting there behind Donald Trump. You know, you've got J.D. Vance and Vivek, and you've got Mike Johnson. You've got this whole crowd day after day now sitting back there. They're the Michael Trumps of the future. They're
Michael Cohen
turning into
the
him.
Future.
Michael Cohen. I'm sorry, Michael Cohen.
Yeah.
They're turning into Michael Cohen.
Literally.
And they're watching him.
Yeah.
Literally. And they're watching him in this low, brought absolutely low by his, you know, by his own behavior in service of this man. And they're doing exactly the same thing. I mean, there's absolutely no self-awareness of where this leads. And I don't know if it leads that place for all of them. Some of them, maybe just one of them, but this is not going to end well for these people. I mean, this kind of demonstration of total lack of any kind of personal integrity and just, you know, basic groveling for this man in public, that just can't last.
And they're all
something that people want to see.
And they're all doing it while they're wearing Trump costumes, you know, navy suit and red ties. I mean, it reminds me of Saddam Hussein. Remember in Iraq, everyone had Saddam Hussein mustaches? It's the same thing now with the red ties. Keith, you're a former lifelong Republican. I won't hold it against you. But didn't you guys used to have a thing against speaking about criminal investigations and trials while they were still in progress, as the Republicans used to pretend to be the law and order party? Wasn't that a thing? Am I remembering that?
Yeah, back in the good old days when the Republican Party actually claimed to be the party that respected the rule of law. Yes, that was absolutely true. And then now, you know, you talked about Trump trying to appeal to his electorate.
Mm-hmm.
What Trump needs to realize is that right now he's got an electorate of 12 people, and that's it. And they are the only electorate that matters. And he ain't playing to them. He's sleeping his way through the trial and doing everything he can to alienate the jury.
Is it 9 or 12 on the jury? I just got confused when you said 12. For some reason, I was thinking it was 9. It's 12, though, isn't it?
It's 12, and they've got six alternates. Yeah.
Okay, that's
12 angry men. Remember?
Oh yes, thank you very much. You are correct, Keith. The statements from the surrogates, by the way, as Trump himself described them as surrogates, are pretty much identical to the complaints that Trump's now forbidden to make. But isn't he also forbidden by that gag order from causing others to make such statements? They sounded like things exactly like he has been saying.
Yeah. Yes, he is.
Can they be held in contempt for that, or can he?
He could. I mean, you'd need to actually prove that he caused it, you know, and his attorneys will say, well, Your Honor, that was just a clumsy choice of words by our client to describe them as surrogates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't, you know, they'll say he didn't coordinate anything with them. And, you know, he doesn't have to. He doesn't have to call up Rick Scott and say, Rick, I want you to say this, and you know, and I want you to say that, you know, somebody else to say this, and you know, he doesn't have to. He just knows he has to make the general call that he already did, and the toadies came a croaking.
They did. Heather, we have heard for weeks, month, but actually, arguably years, that Michael Cohen would be a terrible witness, given his history as a convicted liar. He has a hot temper. He has a lust for revenge against his former boss. Now, there still will be at least one more day of cross-examination of Cohen by the defense. But after a day and a half of direct and a few hours of cross, what's your general takeaway from what we have learned about and heard about from Michael Cohen so far this week?
Well, from what I understand, I mean, not being there and basically just reading, I have only read the transcript from Monday. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the one from yesterday, but it appears that he did fine. You know, I mean, granted, apparently there were a lot of leading questions. Maybe Keith can speak to that. But I don't think that, you know, that the defense wasn't objecting all over the place. So, you know, I don't know that the jury's really aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Cohen was, he kept his, you know, composure. He was poised, apparently. He answered properly. He didn't, you know, get upset or anything. And, you know, basically what he did, from what I can tell from reading the transcript, it was just over and over again, you know, yeah, I know I did this. And it was, you know, I regret it.
Right.
It was the wrong thing to do. And it's landed me in nothing but but hell for everything that I did. And I'm telling you right now that, you know, this stuff was all done on behalf of Donald Trump. He knew all about it. And look where it's got me. I mean, you got this feeling at the end of his testimony yesterday, from what I could gather, was that, you know, his regrets seem sincere. Now, maybe he's a good actor and he's able, you know, it's pure revenge and he's going to make a bunch of money or whatever. But it just seemed to me like the guy was, at least the way that people were portraying him, was kind of, you know, he's a broken man and he's just sitting there going, you know, yeah, well, you know, look what happened.
And much of that came out.
This is what I did.
And much of that came out under the direct from the prosecution itself, as you were reading the Monday transcript. Keith, you wrote about Tuesday. At Daily Kos yesterday, we had long heard, of course, that the defense was going to chew up Cohen on the stand in cross. You could never put him on the stand for anything. Well, did they chew him up in the first half day or so of cross-examination on Tuesday?
No, they didn't. And I'll probably have a couple of things to say about this. You know, first of all, the fact that the prosecution got Cohen to say all of those things that he lied about and the terrible things that he did and how bad he felt about it. That's a standard technique. It's the phrase for it is inoculating the jury even. Mm-hmm. So they so that when the defense comes up and says the same thing about it, you know, the jury is like, well, we've already heard this, you know, and the prosecution brought it up, you know? So, and frankly, the defense probably did over harp on it and will continue to over harp on it, you know, tomorrow. And the jury is going to be, you know, we've already been told this. We already know this.
Over harp on the fact beyond that he's a liar and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay.
But beyond that, Cohen kept his cool. And let me give you an example. One of the things I thought was one of the high moments for his cross-examination testimony, you know, where he shouldn't be having the high moments. And that was when the defense pushed him on, you know, whether or not he wanted Trump convicted, whether or not, you know, Cohen wanted to see a conviction in this case. Mm-hmm. And Cohen said, I would like to see accountability. It's not for me. It's for the jury in this court. That is a beautiful answer, because he is telling the jury, I respect you. Mm. I respect what you are doing. And, you know, even if it doesn't give me what I want, I understand and I respect you. And, you know, it's all about you.
And there was there was one on that point. I think it was Norm Eisen I had read, who was in the courtroom, who said that there was a point when Michael Cohen was, you know, had turned directly to the jury and he was speaking with them and that they were all listening to him rapt, and that for the first time in the trial, he had seen a witness who had actually developed a relationship, a repartee,
with the
jury, that they seemed to like him. And I've always found him to be very likable, despite everybody saying, oh, he's a terrible jerk, he's a whatever. You know, since his turn, since he gave up the Trump cult, as he called it, and admitted on the stand that he was a, what did he say? I was knee-deep in the Trump cult.
Knee-deep in the Trump cult.
Yeah.
The cult of Trump.
Yeah, the cult of, he has come across as, I think, a very likable guy who admits to what he did wrong. Now, last week, Keith, before the before Cohen's testimony, I made the case that while the falsified payment scheme had been very well laid out and described by prosecutors and witnesses, none of the witnesses actually called by the prosecution had testified to Trump's direct knowledge of it, of the falsified payments, that it, you know, still could have been Michael Cohen or even Alan Weisselberg just simply going rogue on their own somehow to protect Trump without his knowledge. Does that smoking gun document that we described in the segment you heard Rachel Maddow summarize, does that, and more specifically, Cohen's testimony about discussing that document with Weisselberg and Trump himself in his office, does that take care of that problem, that concern about the prosecution as you see it?
Well, if it doesn't. Okay, and first of all, it's very strong because it's a statement of what we are going to do, right? Here's the plan.
Right.
I saw, is there evidence that the plan was executed? Well, one of the things that the prosecution spent a lot of time with going on, and it was exceptionally repetitive, but they went through every check.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They
mm-hmm.
went through every check signed by Trump, and they had Cohen walk through it, and they showed that when Trump got the check to sign, attached to that check was Cohen's invoice with mm-hmm. the false statement that it was for a retainer. And in fact, on the check stub itself, each check had a check stub, and mm-hmm. on the check stub itself was for Cohen retainer. And Cohen walked through that with the pictures of the checks and the check mm-hmm. stub and the invoice, up there on the screen for the jury to see. So, I mean, the prosecution did a beautiful job of saying, look, they had this meeting with Trump and Weisselberg and Cohen, and they all agreed what they were going to do. And then, look, you can see for yourself, they did it. And Trump did it.
Can Trump's defense attorneys say that Trump never participated in that meeting, that Cohen is making it up, without Trump being called to the stand to say so? Can the defense put that forward? And either way, doesn't it come down to a sort of a he said, she said without testimony from Weisselberg himself to break the tie? Why isn't he being called to the stand by the prosecution? Doesn't that look to the jury like they're trying to hide something?
Well, it won't be he said when she doesn't get up there and say anything. And by the she, I mean Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
Okay, because right now the only testimony that we have on this is Cohen's
right.
under oath. And, of course, the defense is going to do the best they can to discredit that. But there won't be anything contradicting what he said. And there'll be plenty corroborating what he said to include that document trail that discussed by Matto and that I just mentioned. And, and to include Cohen's testimony and the fact that so much else of what Cohen has said has been corroborated either by other witnesses or by documents. Every phone call that Cohen talked about, when Cohen testified about that phone call, the jury was presented with an exhibit from the phone company showing that phone call happened. Now, the exhibit didn't say what was said in that phone call, but it corroborated that on that date and time that, Cohen's talking about, Trump and Cohen had a phone call.
But without Weisselberg, let me ask you that. Without Weisselberg showing up to testify, can the defense contest that discussion of that meeting with Weisselberg, Cohen in Trump's office? Can the defense say that never happened, or do they need to have Donald Trump actually come on the stand to say that before they can make the argument?
They don't need. What they will say is that the burden is on the prosecution to prove all of the things in Cohen's testimony,
mm-hmm.
and there is no reason for you to believe Cohen's testimony. That's how the defense will likely present that,
mm-hmm.
is that, this is a very high burden of proof here, and if you have a basis to have reasonable doubt about what Cohen said, then you cannot, establish guilt beyond reasonable doubt. That's how they'll present that to the jury.
And the only way to do that is they can't say that didn't happen. They can just basically say Michael Cohen is a liar. Don't believe anything he has testified
that's right.
to, basically.
Just like they also said that Stormy Daniels was a liar.
Right.
It's like when your defense is that everybody's a liar, that doesn't come across as reasonable.
Gotcha.
And they don't have an alternative theory of the case to explain the things that are indisputable.
Hmm. Gotcha.
They don't. They can't present to the jury a narrative of what did happen that makes sense with known facts and leaves Trump innocent. And that can be pretty compelling to a jury.
At least without Trump testifying. And it seems impossible to think that he would be dumb enough to do that.
I know that we're going to present at least one witness on defense. There's an expert witness they're going to put up who I expect to testify to the effect of, Trump wouldn't necessarily know what was going on around him in a big company like this and stuff like that. I don't know what he's
good
going
luck.
To testify to, but that's kind of my guess.
In other words, they'll try to find some way to insert even just the tiniest little bit of reasonable doubt.
That's right. Any good defense counsel hammers on reasonable doubt beginning, middle, and end of the case.
Heather, there have been references throughout this trial to other crimes that Trump was involved in that have not been charged. I was troubled, for instance, by Cohen's testimony that after he was raided by the FBI, had his phones taken and so forth, he received a call from Donald Trump. Now, this is the time that Donald Trump was already president. I think this is we're in 2018 at this point. And Trump told him, you know, effectively, hey, don't worry, you'll be fine. I'm the president now. Stay tough. You're going to be OK. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. That alone, it seems to me, would have been enough to lead, you know, to the impeachment and or resignation of any other president in U.S. history, at least until Donald Trump. And those remarks, those messages from Trump were documented via email from his various lawyers and so forth. I mean, that he's not even charged with that. That's just sort of a sidebar in this mess.
Well, it is. And, you know, I mean, this all came up in Cohen's first trial the case that he pled guilty to. Donald Trump was named as, you know, what was it?
Individual one.
Yes.
He was obviously a co-conspirator in this, and all of this had been looked at by the feds. They knew that Donald Trump was doing this. He was committing obstruction of justice. He was, you know, witness tampering. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was clear he was doing it in broad daylight. I mean, he was putting it out on his Twitter feed at the time, you know, saying, I know, you know, and it's my favorite part. And I think this came up in the trial. Maybe Keith remembers this better than I do from yesterday. That it came up, he had actually put out a tweet saying, Michael Cohen has a lovely family. And, you know, he is a very loyal person. You know, it's like, hey, nice little family you got there, Michael. Yeah. It'd be a shame if anything happened to it.
Yeah.
And as it happens, that was what they held over Cohen's head to get the guilty plea was some threat to you know, go after his wife on some of these tax evasion charges.
Yeah.
So they were going to do that. So, you know, all of this kind of mafia type behavior that, you know, we saw in what you're talking about, Brad, and what we've seen in the past on this, all of this came down through the Justice Department. The story that Cohen told about how he went to, you know, he was going to go and get a new ankle bracelet, and they were going to sign, and he was on some kind of a furlough, and they stopped him and said, no, you got to report down to the SDNY, and they ended up taking him off to jail and put him in solitary confinement because he wouldn't agree to give up his First Amendment rights.
Yep.
That is so dirty. The judge actually threw that out and let Cohen out of jail. But that was something. In fact, I heard somebody on TV say that probably came down from the Bureau of Prisons rather than the Justice Department, or rather than the SDNY, which, of course, you know, they all report to the same guy, right? The Bureau of Prisons were part of Bill Barr's shock troops, as we know, throughout, you know, all the George Floyd protests. So, you know, this was the kind of thing that they were doing. I mean, it was clear, and we saw it in you know, Trump was saying this stuff publicly, and he's never been held accountable for any of that,
never.
And he never will be.
And there's,
this is the best we can hope for, unfortunately.
I mean,
it's insane.
When you read some of the evidence that they have on this, you know, messages from Rudy Giuliani and Bob Costello, both who were attorneys for Trump at various times after the raid, sleep well tonight. You have friends in high places. My friend has communicated to me that he's meeting with his client this evening. His friend was Rudy Giuliani, and he added that if there was anything you wanted to convey, you should tell me, and my friend will bring it up for discussion with his client. This is mobster talk by the president and his attorneys. Keith, we've got just a minute or so here. Trump and his surrogates have been claiming that this trial has been a disgrace. It's an outrage. It's a total, led by a totally conflicted, completely unfair, out-of-control judge. You've been through a lot of trials yourself, setting aside the historic aspects and the media circus around this actual trial. After 5 weeks, is there anything particularly unusual or unfair, that could be used for a potential appeal down the road about this case and its presentation by New York prosecutors as you see it?
No, once the trial has gotten started, it's run pretty normal. I think that other than the defense counsel appearing to follow the wishes of their client rather than engage in sound trial practice in some of their approach to cross-examining witnesses, it's been a normal case. It's been a normal fraud case with prosecutors meticulously spelling out the link between testimony and documentation.
If the defense chooses to not put up a case in response, in 30 seconds here, what should we take from that, Keith?
Well, I think I've heard that they plan to call at least one witness. Mm-hmm. I mean, the question of whether or not they call Donald Trump, I certainly can't imagine them doing that. But I think that they're going to call at least one witness. I'm not sure who it is. I heard it was an expert witness. Mm-hmm. So they'll throw up some sort of defense. But what they'll say that means, of course, is that they don't need to put up a defense because the prosecution hasn't proved its case. The reality of it will be is that they just couldn't find any witnesses who could help.
Well, we will find out by this time next week, I suspect. The cross-examination continues of Michael Cohen on Thursday. There is then no court on Friday because Trump's son, Barron, the one that his wife was nursing as a infant when Trump was allegedly having sex with a porn star, he is graduating from high school on Friday, so the judge has given them a Friday off. Heather, are you going to that graduation? And more importantly, is Trump going to that graduation?
Well, there is some question about that because he is scheduled for some kind of a fundraiser, I think, in Wisconsin. Or it's a libertarian convention in Wisconsin. Am I right about that? And that he's been invited and he's supposedly going, and nobody can figure out how he's going to do both things. So we'll see what happens with that. But I wouldn't be surprised if he skips it. You know, who cares, right?
Wow.
What are you going to do to me, Judge? Put me in jail?
Right. Wow. We will see. All right. We'll pick this up, I suppose, very soon. Heather Digby Parton, thank you very much as ever for joining us. You can find her work at salon.com or digbysblog.net and also on the Twitters at Digby56. You can also find Keith Barber over at dailycoast.com where he writes as simply Keith DB. And he is on the Twitters as well at KeithDB80. And Keith, I know you took time out of your birthday celebrations to join us here today. So I am mighty grateful and a happy birthday to you, sir.
All right. Well, thank you, Brad. It was fun.
Thank you both. We will talk to you both soon. Much appreciated.
Okay. You bet.
All right, we have got to get out.
Yes.
My thanks as well to our delightful producer, Desi Doyen.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Des. And to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other we have ever done, you can download them anytime for free at bradblog.com. There is no paywall there. Thanks to those of you who help keep the Brad Blog running and the broadcast on your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. We can, as always, really use your support right around now for this difficult year. bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email. Love to hear from you. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. We'll see you there until we see you here next time. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.